Welcome to another episode of This Catholic Life, conversations about life's ups and downs, big and small, how we deal with every situation imaginable, whatever life throws at us, but still manage to be sensible, practical, and joyful. Today's show is Educating for Life, a conversation about education, its role in society, what it's good for, and how we go forward with it as Catholics. What do we think about it as Catholics? I'm your host, Peter Holmes, and today I'm joined by Renee Coller-Ryan, my co-host and professor in philosophy at the University of Notre Dame.
Welcome, hello, Peter.
Renee. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
You've been busy flitting all over the world. And
that's right.
Back in
the States. I'm back again. Yep.
And also joined by Andy Mullins, who's a school teacher, former principal of two schools over a couple of decades we were just talking about, almost two decades, and author of the book Parenting for Character, and also completed a PhD in neuroscience and virtue in the context of education. Welcome, Andy.
Peter, good to be here, mate.
Just by way of disclosure, Andy did his PhD at Notre Dame, but also we go a little way back further than that, so he's a good friend. Let's dive right into today's topic, educating for life. We should begin by defining what we're talking about here. So perhaps we'll go for definitions initially to the philosopher.
Oh, no. and the philosopher immediately goes to etymology, right?
Right.
So it's a leading out of. So the question is, what is it leading out of and what is it leading toward?
That's an excellent question.
Yeah, education leading toward, I think, ideally within the Catholic context, I think especially, ideally leading us toward a greater appreciation of where we are situated within the grand scheme of things and an ability to think about what it is to lead a good life, an ability to really contemplate things that are of lasting worth.
Right. Andy, would you like to give us a perspective from the school teacher's point of view?
Well, I'm a fraud as a school teacher.
Oh, a fraud.
An absolute fraud.
Like,
because
I
actually am a teacher by accident.
Oh, really?
And I...
There's a story behind this. We must hear it.
Can we call this episode the accidental teacher?
Absolutely.
Instead of,
yeah. I remember vividly sitting in school when I was in year 12, looking at my maths teacher and thinking, he didn't look the happiest man at the time, thinking that this is what teaching does to you and I never want to be a teacher. And then,
was he teaching geometry at the time though?
Oh dear. Anyway, I had no intention of being a teacher when I left school. And later, I ended up in teaching, and also by accident, because my first day of teaching, I went to the wrong school. So that was a further embarrassment.
How do you do that?
And then they pointed out the window and said, no, that's your school out there, that little portable on the field outside.
Oh, okay.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And then my very first day in front of a class, my very first period, the very first thing I did as a teacher was hand out sheets, and the very first boy that I handed a sheet to screwed it up and threw it on the ground.
Oh.
So it was a very interesting induction into teaching. So what's education about?
Mm.
I actually like to come back to the whole idea that we're raising young people to think for themselves.
Right.
That they can love wisely, they can love according to what they know to be true. So I think education is about imparting truth.
You said a couple of things there. You said think for themselves, but you also said love. And love is not restricted to thinking, is it?
No, it's not. And that's a really good point, because I suppose we can either love impulsively,
mm-hmm.
which you would put in the field of desires, if you like, or we can love reflectively and
right.
on conviction and mm. something that we know is good.
We sort of make a virtue out of impulsive love, don't we, in Western society? Like mm. it's like...
Oh, we over-romanticize.
Yeah, real love comes from this just sort of a spontaneous burst, and almost if you do something as routine, well, that's not, you know, that's kind of just routine, not real love coming out of an impulse.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. I went to an opening of a new philosophical project on Saturday night in Melbourne. A friend of mine has started a small non-profit school called the Independent School of Philosophy.
Right.
And we launched it in a gallery. And he gave us a short talk on how basically the Enlightenment, in the philosophers leading up to the Enlightenment, elevated emotion and feelings
yeah.
and desires and downgraded rationality and,
right.
and clarity of thought.
I'd say they've had a victory in our society.
And we're still wearing it.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
I think their victory is almost complete. It's almost impossible to argue with emotions.
Well, it's the age of emotivism is what Alistair McIntyre talks about.
Mm.
And you can't argue with emotions, because if someone says, I'm offended or
yeah.
I love this, or you can't argue with that. Yeah, because it's not actually a reason that's coming forward.
So, Renee, this is our job as teachers.
I know, to get them to think. When they say to me, what I feel is, I always say, no, no, I don't care about all of that. Tell me about what you think. And then we'll figure out the feeling stuff as well. But you've got to figure out what the true is.
Very
and with that, the,
yeah,
the good and the beautiful.
But not just thinking, like not getting them to think, but actually seeing the value of thinking. So because, for example, there are a lot of people that we teach who can actually engage with thinking as an exercise. Oh, this is an interesting thing to do in my spare time. But they don't actually necessarily make the connection to this is necessary for everyday, for a virtuous life, a good life.
Mm. And sometimes I think it's interesting the connection between thinking and character. Mm. And if we give people the tools of character, then they can think clearly.
By which you mean the virtues.
I'm talking about virtues.
Yeah, good. And
yeah. We need to unpack virtues.
Yeah. So. We will get there.
Give us time.
There was the teacher in him saying, just hold that. We're on our curriculum.
We'll come back to it.
Yes. All right. So we've talked about how you came to be a teacher, or at least some of the interesting stories along the way. It can't have been all accidental. There's something, there's a spark there that made you think this is a worthwhile pursuit, and you've stuck with it for, let's say, some time. What would you say is at the heart of why teachers teach, or rather why you teach?
I remember I grew up in Kensington, Randwick and then Kensington in Sydney. And I remember visiting the parish priest who was then in an old priest's home, if you like.
Right.
His name was Father Tozzi.
Right.
And I just switched out of architecture into teaching because I'd been doing some work in youth groups, and it sort of grabbed my imagination. And then he sort of sat back as a patriarch.
Yes.
He said, those who instruct others in the paths of virtue shall shine like the stars.
Ah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've never forgotten it.
Yeah.
And and I'm sure it's a line out of one of the books of the Old Testament. I've forgotten which one. But it left a big impression on me.
Yeah.
Mm. Maybe I can throw this in since you've invoked scripture, that in the scriptures – education is the primary responsibility of the parents. Mm. So that I've looked in the scriptures for things on discipline, everything. Everything's under the banner of education. Mm. Discipline only matters insofar as you're educating someone for character, for virtue. Well, the scriptures would talk about it in terms of the moral life.
And it's a total prerequisite.
Yeah.
If a person has not been raised with character, they can't manage their emotional life, and yeah, they will not be able to then think clearly.
And you can tell, and we said this on previous episodes, you can, when you say of someone, they're a credit to their parents, it's never they do everything their parents say. It's always that they've acted independently without direct instruction from their parents in a way which demonstrates their character.
I think it's one of the great myths, isn't it, of our time that somehow, whether it's an institution like the Catholic Church or certain ways of thinking somehow restrict our freedom, but in fact they enhance our freedom because we can think more clearly for ourselves.
Well, it's a fairly good test of any philosophy. Let's throw to the philosophy. It's a fairly good test of any philosophy, I would say, that how does it actually encourage you to think independently, or does it bind you to a particular way of thinking?
Yeah, that's right. And that's what philosophy should always be about, searching out what is true and doing it for oneself. So that connection between truth and freedom is there in philosophy. And it's there within Catholic thought whenever we look through, say, papal documents. There's always this connection between truth and freedom. Or like philosophers like to talk about it in terms of objective reality and subjective validity and all of this kind of thing. But basically it means there is reality. Once you know it and you can work with it, you're going to be free. And I often say to my students and to my kids as well, it's a bit like when you've got a block of wood and you're trying to cut it one way, but it's so completely against the grain, you're never going to get anywhere. Whereas if you actually figure out what the grain of the wood is, you'll be able to cut well and you'll be able to make something beautiful.
Let's come back to what education is. Now, I mean, not so much what education is, but what form it takes in Australia. So one of the things we take for granted in our society is that school is, like, we sort of almost directly correlate school and education as if they're exactly the same thing. Your education is how much time you spent in a certain institution or various institutions. But the idea of a certain number of people sitting in a classroom learning for one person is not the way education was always viewed, and that's not the only way of looking at education. Can we talk about how we came to have this particular way of educating, or how and whether it's still useful, how it's useful?
There's been a long tradition in Australia, I think, of parents outsourcing their education to their kids.
Right.
At least in in terms of anything scholastic and academic.
Right.
And
that presumes, doesn't it, that the parents are the first educators. That's something we haven't said out loud yet.
Yeah.
Parents have the responsibility and the right to educate their own children. But then, as you say, the tradition is in Australia, and not just in Australia, that we actually entrust our children to professionals to help us with
and
that.
And where it's gone further than that in Australia is that schools have tended to run their show independently.
Right.
And
independent of the parents.
Independent of the parents. Right. I remember in my first year as a headmaster at Redfield, I was shadowing the principal at a well-known private school in Sydney, and he simply said to me, "Oh, we like to have as little to do with parents as possible."
Wow.
Yeah, very interesting. And you paid big fees to get into that place.
Yeah.
And I think it's an old way of thinking, really, because if we're really to raise young people so that they can cope with the challenges in our society at the moment, which are, in a sense, new, you know, we need to give them a very coherent message, which has been reinforced both in home and in school.
Yeah, which means you need cooperation, at the very least, between home and school. And it means that if we're going to actually follow through on this Catholic idea that, and not just Catholic, but the sound idea that parents are the first educators, the school, in a sense, needs to take its place as a servant of that process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Whether you talk about partnering parents in education, which is the slogan or the motto, if you like, that the school I'm involved with in Melbourne now has adopted, a small school which is begun by parents called Harkaway Hills College.
Right.
Partnering with parents,
right,
they talk about. I know at Redfield we used to talk about how, as a staff, we wanted to be the school which communicated most effectively with parents.
Right.
That type of idea. And I think some schools have structures whereby they can reinforce the work of parents. But
yeah,
unfortunately, we're also in an age where the architects of the Safe Schools program talk cynically about how they're eliminating parents from the process and so on. So there's a lot of opposition to the idea of working with parents.
Yeah.
There are some practical issues there that a lot of school teachers I know talk to me about, that parents aren't always clear on what they're asking schools to do, or, you know, there seems to be in some people's idea that they sort of pass the child over to the school and then just blame the school for everything that happens.
Yeah.
And often the old meme comes up that if the child's not achieving or there's some problem with their behaviour, they'll blame the teachers for that.
Yeah.
Which is not entirely just every time.
Yeah.
What I've noticed as a parent is that a lot of what comes home from school has to do with the other kids, and by extension, it has to do with what's going on with the parents at home, which is a really interesting thing as well.
Yep.
So the more we try to say that the parents don't have much to do with what's going on with their kids in school and then with other kids in school, I think the less we're able to actually see how we could have a better community of learning that goes beyond the classroom and beyond the school gate.
You said the word community there, and it used to be, maybe I'm being nostalgic about a time that I wasn't actually a Catholic in, but it strikes me as that there used to be quite a strong connection between parish schools and the parish life, because the people in the parish would send the kids to the parish school.
Yeah.
There was a community that worked in and out of that, and hence you had that community. It's not as, I mean, it's still there, but it's not as strong a connection, it seems now. But, I mean, when I challenged, I'm not going to name schools at all, but when I challenged one particular school about their way of teaching language, I went all the way to the top, like into their head office kind of person, guru of this language thing. And he simply told me, "I'm the professional, you're not, go away," kind of thing. And at which point I said, "Actually, I teach languages at university. I know what I'm talking about. And I'm afraid you're wrong about this." Now, I might have been wrong, but the point was there's an attitude there of a kind of we're the professionals, you're not, which seems to have come through in the principle you talked about before.
I'd slightly distinguish because, in a sense, the math teacher knows more about maths teaching than most parents.
Which is why we've trusted our kids to him.
So we do, you know, we send kids to a sporting coach because he's got expertise in that area. In a sense, the school has expertise, but once the school says that it's doing it as an independent body and it's not subservient to the parents, that the parents are the primary people responsible, it becomes an issue, I think, seriously.
Good distinction, actually. Well, I mean, we need to talk about the challenges that are there in school life, because we've got less and less involvement from parents in Sydney, partially because we have double working parents. We have lots and lots of people who are tied up. I mean, we're getting a lot busier and busier lives. I know at some of the schools you've been involved with, you try and engage parents a lot, but even getting them into the school building and trying to talk to them is a challenge sometimes.
You need structures of expectations.
Right.
I think you need to actually say when parents enroll in a school, listen, we actually want to see you up here 4 times a year.
Right.
We want to see you at parent functions where we are trying to give you information that will help you.
Mm. And also structures of communication, because as far as I remember, the schools also had a clear ways of and personal contacts which you couldn't communicate with.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of that, because the schools that I've been involved in have come from St. Jose Maria's inspiration, really,
right.
who was the founder of Opus Dei, and he... In the very first school that started in Spain, I remember I went over there on a study visit at one stage, and they said to me, listen, St. Jose Maria told us in the 1950s that education must be personal. You must talk to each child individually. You must deal with each family personally. You can't educate people en masse.
And, right.
And that's really then flowed through into those schools, and we've copied and picked it up, basically.
I think most teachers would agree with you that the interpersonal contact is the important thing. But I guess the challenge would be, and we face this in university too, I mean, one-on-one education would be our ideal as well. But in practice...
Sometimes. Yeah, let's be realistic here. Sometimes you really don't want to be for hours on end with some students. At that particular point in their education.
Yeah, fair
maybe
enough.
Later on we'd come back to them.
But
I'm not sure they would want to be with us either.
That's true. Some of them like to hide in the corner and not be seen.
We shouldn't idealise. That's my point.
Yes, my children seem to have excelled at being the quiet one in the corner and just not causing any ruffles, and so therefore getting away with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I still picture your son as very quiet in the corner.
For the listener, my son is literally sitting in the corner being quiet at this particular podcast. Nice dig. The point is that that interpersonal, if you like, ideal is challenged by the fact that school teachers are in front of a bunch of kids who they have for a limited amount of time, particularly in high school, because they've only got for a period or something, or a couple of periods, and they've got 30, you know, up to 30 kids, 20 to 30 kids in front of them, and it's really quite difficult to give that personal contact to 30 kids, even if they were all perfectly behaved, which doesn't always happen.
So how do we do it?
Yeah.
I mean, good teaching will certainly deal with the kids individually in a classroom.
Right.
I think that's certainly the case. You will certainly get around and know where each kid's strengths and difficulties are.
Mm.
But all that said, you can also put other programs in place in a school where children are very closely tracked and understood, whether it's in the homeroom or whether it's through a mentoring program or through meetings after school where teachers compare notes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's necessary. There's so much bureaucracy involved in school, but it's ridiculous to spend our bureaucratic hours ticking boxes when we should be talking about the young people in our care.
Right.
So how do you get around that? That's something that strikes us in the tertiary sector as well. Everything becomes more and more bureaucratized, so then you have less and less time to think about the importance of teaching and how to teach better.
Mm.
Do you find that also?
A really good axiom, I think, is we teach students, not subjects.
Yeah.
So it's good to talk about that a lot.
Yeah.
At least at the school level. Maybe at the tertiary level it's less significant because there's a body of truth to impart in a sense that's more impartial or whatever the right word is.
Yeah, but there's still moments, I'd say, Renee, wouldn't you, that there's still moments in class where you know you've come with this lecture but someone asks a question and you think, this is a teachable moment.
Mm.
I'd like to take 10 minutes to actually address this this side topic. And we've got a little bit of liberty to do that within
reason.
Oh,
we have a lot of liberty, I think, to do that.
And then there's the whole issue of interpersonal skills. I'm thinking of a fantastically erudite man that I taught with at one stage, but he never smiled. And when he walked along the corridors, he didn't look up and he didn't smile at the students as they walked towards him. And you don't need Mother Teresa to tell you that a smile is a bridge.
Right.
And very interesting.
I
remember one little guy, a story in year two. One, I asked a boy once he moved into year three the next year, have you got teaching you? And he told me the name of the teacher. And then he said, he's wonderful. My last teacher didn't smile.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Makes you think.
Yeah, it does. I know my kids have learned from the warmer teachers at their younger stages of development. And then as they've gotten older, my eldest in particular really has responded to the strict but kind. Mm. So it's been an interesting kind of thing. She just excels when someone's pushing and pushing and pushing, but has a bit of a sense of humour about it. Mm. Yeah.
I'd push it a little further, Andy. I think you're being a little too modest about this. As I walk behind you, I think you remember a couple of times I came to talk at Redfield, and as I walked through the school with you, you weren't just smiling at the kids, you knew their names and you knew something about
very interesting.
About
them. We had a leadership day once that was pitched at the leaders of the classes. We call them class secretaries. And I asked some of the senior boys to prepare a short video, and they went videoing little grabs from people, and they had this grab of a little guy in year five saying, what does he value about senior students in the school? He says, I just want them to know my name.
Ah.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy in a Protestant youth organisation who's had a lot of success in getting youth movements up and running in this very difficult time. And he said the first thing is, in the parish, get your senior people in the parish, like literally just older people, to learn the names of the youth. And just name them as they come in the door. Hey, how you doing? And ask and find one thing about them. If you know their name and one thing, that it changes their whole attitude. Yeah. I belong here. I actually matter here. I'm a person someone cares about.
Yeah, the schools I've been involved in have had these mentoring programs, where each of the students has a teacher who's their mentor, and in principle talks with them fortnightly. I think what we noticed as time has gone on, that if you don't see kids with that regularity, the line drops out.
Mm.
I mean, a fortnight is a long time for a young person.
Yes.
And so what does that mean about the teacher in the classroom? They really have to connect personally with each of their kids in that classroom.
That's
great
intense.
Constancy, yeah.
That's a pretty intense load. I mean, because having personal relationships is a really big deal, and you can't, you know, that's an investment. You can't fake that kind of investment.
Maybe that's why my maths teacher was so sad.
Couldn't fake the investment. You could see how that would be startling for a mathematician.
Yeah, I have to confess, I had two maths teachers who actually left teaching with what they used to call mental breakdowns back then. So I'm not sure if that was geometry or I went on to do engineering as my first degree. So who knows? I don't know if they inspired me or maybe what determined to do it. Can I come back to the curriculum issue? Because we talked about admin and all kinds of administrative burdens on us, but there's something a bit more in schools in Australia, that they have a universal, like a national curriculum, which is quite, you know, specified. What's the word? It's dictated to us.
Yeah.
How do you teach with that kind of organic relationship and talk about virtue in this homogenised kind of curriculum?
I think it's very possible as long as we keep reminding ourselves that human beings are not brains. Human beings have this need for being understood, and they have an emotional need for empathy and whatever. So part of that is just the teacher education that we provide, and that we educate our teachers to work with parents. I know at one stage I did a survey of I talked in a conference of principals about how well we prepared teachers or didn't prepare teachers to work with parents. And I surveyed a lot of teachers and got their feedback, and many of them said that they felt unprepared to communicate with parents. And that's a real problem. If they can't communicate with parents, they can't certainly partner them very well in education. And
so in their degrees they were prepared, and their training they were prepared to deal with students but not parents is what you're saying.
That's right. It was a blind spot.
Okay.
And and so there was this fear of parents almost, and I understand that. It can be pretty intimidating for a 22-year-old who's got their first day in class. But
I wouldn't like to be on the other side of the table to me.
And there's the whole thing, the growth of the customer relationship, you know,
that
parents can fall into the trap of looking on the school as their as a provider of a service that, and they're the customer, and the customer's always right.
That's a really interesting point. It's almost like a consumer product. You know, I'm paying this much money, therefore I demand you give me what I'm paying for.
So induction of new parents into a school is really important.
Right.
How we talk about the culture in the school, how we talk about the expectations of parents, and all of that then plays into the classroom. Because children will, in a sense, mirror their parents' attitudes.
Right.
And whether their parents are very academically motivated, then the kids will be more motivated in their studies very often. Or if the parents are fairly derogatorily talking about teachers at home, then, you know, kids will be criticising the teachers around the table, and it's not a good recipe.
Hmm. One of the questions that comes up often in Catholic circles is that all schools in Australia have to be accredited according to the government regulations, and also they receive a certain amount of funding, and therefore there's certain criterion we have to meet. We have to match up to what the government says about schooling. And there might be some interesting times coming with the government putting in regulations with regards to, you know, things like safe schools or, you know, other criterion in terms of curriculum. Do you see, are you hopeful about that, navigating that? Or
I think you look overseas and you see the tidal wave coming at times, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And in Victoria, it's a very different environment than it is here.
Yeah, the tidal wave always comes from the south.
It does. Like us. We're from the south, you know? I'm Victorian.
Originally. Yeah, a long time ago, Renee.
but still.
But yeah, I mean, certainly I'm concerned about Victoria, and I'm concerned that, in a sense, the rest of the states in Australia are one vote away from this, one election away from this, in a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's nonsense what's happening, you know, with politicians.
I think we probably need to talk about what is actually happening with the safe schools as well, because for all of us it's become a kind of byword, but the safe schools curriculum or push within Victoria is really a push for gender ideology, which is being, when you look at, I've seen just... I don't know, but parents have been taking photographs of what's been sent home to them from school. They haven't been consulted at all about what's been going on in their schools, but just the way that sexuality is being talked about and gender identity, which is from a very ideological stance, is being talked about, has been quite traumatizing. I've had friends down there who have said that their kids have come home crying because they've been so traumatized by what they've been presented with. So, and the parents then are trying to do this kind of damage control, and it's just being quite dreadful.
Yeah, so, and you step back and it's the absolute arrogance of people who think they know better than the parents.
That's right.
The arrogance of politicians who want to social engineer the family or social personality.
That's right.
Some people might accuse Catholics of that. They might. I mean, I'm just playing the devil's advocate here.
So how do we get to the truth? And that's where the philosopher comes in, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, is all truth relative? Is your truth different to mine? Or, or is there a truth about human beings and that male and female are actually in some way different, although we're both the same species? We've got distinctive features, and therefore we should respect those features. Yeah. And in what do those features lie? In the biology.
Yeah. Even more than the biology, let's put it on the table, Andy, that some of your work has been in educating boys in particular.
Yeah.
And can we talk a little bit about that, perhaps, about some of the differences in your experience of educating boys and girls?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Step back, what's driving co-education, if you like? Because there's schools with their absolute backs to the wall in Europe, for example, and in South America, where the government is putting enormous pressure on single-sex schools to become co-ed.
Right.
What's driving that? Part of it is a social agenda.
Right.
And part of it is economics, that it's actually cheaper to run co-ed schools.
Sure.
And build joint facilities, et cetera.
Mm.
And because education is such a big ticket item on every political budget, they're looking for ways to cut down the cost. I mean, medicine and education are the two big...
Right.
Big expenses.
Even healthcare.
Healthcare. Very interesting.
But let's come back to the boys.
Yep.
You know, so what's different about a boy, educating a boy and a girl?
Okay, so you look at every family. Family's got a boys and girls, and parents will treat their boys and girls differently normally.
Mm. If we try not to, I'd have to say it doesn't work out.
absolutely. Intuitively, we know that boys and girls are different, and there's all sorts of experiments in psychology that show that with small infants.
Mm.
So it's loopy. It's a myth to say that you can treat boys and girls the same.
Interesting. When our kids were young, I was trying to go against the idea that you say to one child, you can play with the prams and you can do that. So, and in fact, my boys wanted to play with the girls' toys, except, I was a bit nervous at first, and then I said, no, I'll just let them sort it out. But it's instantly, like, the boys wanted the pram, but as soon as they got it, they played race cars. We're like, and the doll's house was earthquakes.
I was just up in Wagga, or down in Wagga.
Yep.
And I was over with the family, some friends, and I was met by the two little boys who were like 3 and 2.5 or something like this, with their pet snails at the front gate. They were very proudly showing me their pet snails, you know. Yeah. And then And then they produced their pet snail house. So this was was sort of something that the parents were actually encouraging. It was fantastic.
Well, I should say I have four boys and they're all very different personalities and they express their masculinity in all sorts of ways. So it's not just one way of doing it. And one of them's not at all sporty or in that way inclined, but he's completely, you know, he's very different to his sisters in that respect.
Sure.
And so go on, you're about to tell us the difference.
So, I mean, typically you'd be talking about how boys need more structure.
Right.
I think the value of male role models in a school is plays out in sport, but it doesn't just play out in sport because really we're teaching young boys to be men, right?
Right.
And so it's useful to have role models of men around, right?
Right.
And masculinity comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes, but it's really important that we start to see the common ground there.
Right. Can I maybe throw a curveball at you there? Young people need role models of male and female.
Yep.
They need their mum and their dad, and they need male and female role models. What about the argument that, yes, okay, it's good to have male role models in the school, but what about, you know, the fact maybe they also need to have at least some input from females?
No question. And I suppose what I would cite then is looking back, having taught for 25 or 30 years in boys' schools and seeing how so many of these young men are very happily married now with their own families and sending the next generation to the same schools and realize they've met beautiful girls and they know how to respect girls. And there's a lot of evidence there that boys are not at all socially disadvantaged.
Right.
And in fact, I would say that in a big city like Sydney or Melbourne or wherever, I would say one of the more compelling reasons for children to go to a single-sex school is not just because for boys it's more practical and for girls it's more, there's more encouragement in exploration and whatever. I think it's also that it gives parents a little bit more management of the social life of the kids.
Okay.
I taught in the government system before Redfield started and we all looked fondly on as the brightest girl in year 11 was going hand in hand with a boy in the playground for 6 months. And then she left to have the baby.
Right.
And I'm thinking, we let down that girl. We let down that family.
Right.
Because we didn't do anything and the parents had no idea that this was happening.
Right. Yeah. Social control is a difficult one in any school system, though. I mean, it's not a given that just because you've got single-sex school, you're going to control.
No, absolutely. But it's more a matter of giving parents a little bit of a level playing field where they can be more part of the issue.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll often say to parents of teenagers, look, how do you know what your kids are doing?
Mm.
You only know if they tell you. So you have to be so close to your kids that they open their hearts to you. You cannot look in their. You shouldn't look in their drawers. You shouldn't check their phones. You shouldn't be prying on them.
Mm.
But if you don't have such a close relationship with your kids that they tell you what they're doing, then they'll be talking to people on Facebook, and you will have no idea what they're saying.
That leads us to maybe I can throw at Renee, but it's the other parent of the room here. How do we get engaged with our kids when they're spending so much time at school and we're spending so much time at work, and then there's a like a narrow window of opportunity, if you like, between sleeping and coming home from school. It does it make it more difficult or
working and being a parent? Yes. Always difficult. I found that maximizing time in the morning and the evening is the way to go, and then making sure that there's individual time on the weekend. But we also have a fairly tried and true routine in the evening, which is that we all have dinner together and we're talking a lot at dinner. And sometimes they get annoyed at me because I'm asking them questions about different things, but it's, you know, trying to get the conversation going. And the kids are actually quite fun now because they'll start up conversations with each other and they've become quite good conversationalists. So they'll turn to me and say, "So Mum, how did this go? How did that go?" So it's actually quite nice. And then we spend time reading together. So
right.
So we're now up to Return of the King. We've been making our way through the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But yeah, I think that probably to get back to what you were saying, which seems to be the theme of the podcast, that relationship between the families and the schools and the kids, I think that that's really important if same-sex schools are going to work. That's been my observation because having lived in the United States and Australia and in Europe and hearing people talk about their different experiences of going to schools, whether it's co-ed or same-sex, I know that some men in particular have said to me that they really wish that they hadn't been sent to a same-sex school and not had any contact at all, really, except for an occasional school dance with the girls. And so one guy who's Irish, he said to me, it just ruined me for about 5 years. I came out, I couldn't talk to any girls at all, and I was unable to have a really good relationship with them as friends, because they were sort of, you know, they were this other species almost that was off in the distance, and I had no way of interacting with them at all. And I, and so he really was very adamantly against same-sex schools for that reason. But that points to, if that's going to work, then there need to be other ways of making sure that there are healthier relationships going on. And he had sisters, so it wasn't as though he wasn't relating to other women at all.
And I think Peter's point about community is very important.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Hmm. One of the things that happens in a number of schools that I've seen and is very successful is when the classes have as part of their ongoing education community engagement. And so the classes will go into nursing homes or go into various community projects and get engaged with the community. And that itself opens it. So I think that's a very positive thing.
Yeah.
We've tended to segregate by school classes or age groups, very, like, we talk about youth and we talk about middle age as if they're some sort of social category. Yeah. It's not. We're so different.
And also, what are we doing with schools? We're outsourcing the academic or scholastic education of the kids.
Yep.
But why are we outsourcing their social education when we've got families?
Yeah, I mean,
families are the best social unit in the business. Yeah. So, you know, really, we don't want parents to walk away from their responsibility to link with other families who have kids, boys and girls, their own kids' age, and help their kids develop with like-minded people.
Yeah. If I can be a little bit provocative here, I'm coming from a particular angle. I should put my cards on the table that I have experienced Catholic schools, as in systemic Catholic schools. I've experienced the parish schools that Andy's talking about, and I've also experienced homeschooling as a parent, not as a child. I was raised in the public school system, so I've got a bit of a spectrum here. But one of the things I'd say to parents is, and maybe I'll put this to you, Andy, is don't be afraid to challenge things, to actually ask the questions. Yes, the teachers know what they're doing and they're trained to teach, but that doesn't make them the parent of your child. And it doesn't mean that they can't be questioned about and challenged about, okay, how does this work with the making my child a great person? How does this actually bring my child into adulthood with the tools that are necessary? What parts aren't being dealt with and what do I need to deal with? And sometimes I've had to say I had to push back on the school systems, various ones, because they were encroaching on the family area. And I just simply said, no, we're not going there. And I'm a stubborn person, so it worked for me. But I've seen other parents scared.
It's a very good point.
To take
because
on.
Because we've allowed schools to do the social development of our kids. Mm. Then we allow them then to do the same sex. The safe schools,
or not even allow, it's being forced on us.
That's right, but we sort of take it for granted because we've forgotten that schools have this expertise that we're asking them to do it, but it's all under my responsibility as a parent.
In fact, there was I can't remember his name, but there was a psychologist from Milan who we taught at the John Paul II Institute many years ago, who said, think about this, the conversations people have in school classes for sex ed, if anybody else in the world had that conversation with a child, with a minor, that would be classed as a sexual assault, like as quite serious crime.
Yeah.
But it seems as if we've kind of wrapped that in a school teaching context and suddenly it's okay. In fact, it's not just okay, it's required.
Yeah.
And often when I've talked to teachers who do these sort of things, they're not entirely comfortable with the idea of entering into this space.
It's very privileged domain, isn't it? Mm.
But the psychologist made this point. He said, for it to be a safe thing and not actually an impingement upon the psychosexual development of a child, it has to be at the child's choosing of time, person, and place. Mm-hmm. And so to be that, the parent has to be accessible to the child. They have to be comfortable with that sort of conversation, and they have to give the time for it.
Yeah, I'd love to see the reference for that. That sounds really good information, okay.
How does the school play its part in mission? So clearly Catholic Church is involved in, very, very involved in churches, but there aren't just systemic Catholic schools. There are private Catholic schools by religious institutions, religious orders, and also private organisations of parents. Clearly Catholics think there's something really big in education that's worth being invested in, and clearly we see it as part of our mission. In what way is a Catholic school a mission field, and how does that relate to religious freedom? Like, we don't just say Catholics can come to school, we say everyone can. Where does religious freedom fit into? And maybe this comes back to the whole principle of education we spoke to at the start.
In an ideal society, what are parents looking for from a school? I think they're looking for expertise in particular subject areas. They're looking for reinforcement of the messages that they're giving their kids and the education they're giving their kids in character. And they're looking for reinforcement of education in the faith, knowing that...
If they're Catholic.
If they're Catholic or...
Or similar, yeah.
And you know, there are areas in faith education where the school can give more detailed information, that's for sure. But normally I'd be saying to parents, listen, there's two aspects to this. One is the knowledge of our faith, and the other is the doctrinal piety, and is the piety of the practice of
the actual
faith.
Practice of it, yeah.
Yeah. And if they don't get that practice side of it very strongly from home, and a very deep conviction about the importance of knowledge of our faith, then it's not going to work, it's not going to stick. So, but it's always in service to the parents.
On the flip side though, if you teach them the theory of the religious side of it and the teachers themselves aren't living it.
Absolutely.
It's not going to have any credibility.
In a sense, both aspects have to be taught in both places.
Sure.
But particularly the thing of piety, I think, has to come through from home.
Okay.
Often schools are involved in sacramental education. That's part of the whole process. I don't know if you've probably read the letter from Pope Benedict about child abuse earlier in this year. Very tough letter. Beautiful letter, but very tough.
Yeah.
But basically he says, listen, how is it possible that people who are responsible for children do all of this bad stuff?
Yeah.
And then the argument of the letter is that as soon as we forget what is true, then we can do anything. We can give ourselves reasons to do anything.
Yeah.
And then he says, we've got to get back to the most important single central truth of our faith, that God is with us in the Blessed Sacrament.
Yes.
And so...
And what that means for the dignity of every person
absolutely.
Involved.
Absolutely. So if a Catholic school doesn't give pride of place to the Blessed Sacrament, it's not a Catholic school.
Right. That's a bit cool.
I think that the reason that Catholics are so invested in so many ways in education is that truth is very personal for Catholics. So truth is a person, the person of Christ. And if we're actually aiming toward truth, we're aiming for this relationship with Christ. And so that's what should be permeating the entire culture of a Catholic school. And that's something that's often forgotten when we're talking about curriculum development and, you know, all of the bureaucratic things and I don't know who's on playground duty and all that kind of thing. the most important thing actually is about, and Benedict the 16th is very, you know, wonderful with this, JP2 was as well. Francis is also, it's about this encounter, Pope Francis, I should say, the Holy Father. It's an encounter with Christ, which has to happen through other persons. And at the same time, through the whole sacramental life of the church. So we can think about education as actually being quite cerebral. And it is part of that. But for Catholics, it's about the formation of a whole person. So we're talking about the emotions, we're talking about the mind, but it's really that formation in love, which is the only way that we can be properly unified with each other and with each other with the life of the Blessed Trinity. So there are, I'm sorry as the philosopher here to come in with the theological dimensions of it all, but I think otherwise, why would we be worried about this at all? If it's not actually about somehow bringing people closer to Christ, then we should just get out of the game because possibly others could do it better if it's only about being really good maths teachers and
good ATAR scores.
Getting good ATAR scores, yeah.
Well, I wanted to go there. Before I do, though, I think it's all coming back to education is personal.
That's right.
And so even when we talk about just ordinary skill development, it's personal because that's the best way to educate. Even if we're talking about ATARs, the best way to get there is personal education. But when we talk about it being a mission field, if we're ever going to transmit the faith, it always has to be personal. And Andy's point about the centrality of the sacrament is that that's a personal connection with Christ.
And one more dimension to the mission is that we're looking outwards. And I believe, honestly, this is a great blind spot in the way that we've raised kids, that we've forgotten that life is, in the words of a priest I've known for 40 years, he says, life is forgiving.
Wow.
And
how does that relate to looking outwards?
So the virtue of generosity is a prerequisite for the virtue for the capacity to love.
Right.
And if we don't teach young people to look outwards, if they become introspective, and that's always going to happen in teenagers unless we teach them not to.
Right.
And there's a guy called David Isaacs who wrote one of the really foundational books on virtue and character building, and he says if we don't raise young people to experience the joy that comes from helping others, then they will not be able to overcome the introspection of their teenage years.
Right.
And I think that's a really, really important idea.
Yeah.
So what's this come down to? Justice and charity.
Right.
And that you know, Aquinas said that justice has to be in every virtue, in every action of virtue.
Giving things what they're due.
And that's quite unfashionable now to talk that way, right? But the reality is that we have to measure every single one of our actions by how we impact on others.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. And but I think people talk about justice, but they tend to label it on a particular cause rather than talking about it.
And it's become
it
very material sort of sense of justice.
Yeah. They don't think about the common good. They're thinking about how I can get whatever I want without doing too much.
That's right. It's harm a self, to someone it's a selfish else. Justice, that's which, right. which is a
which
contradiction.
Isn't justice, actually.
Well, it's not an incorrect idea about justice. So I am owed certain things. But the as you were saying, the looking outwards means realizing you're also owed these things, and you're also
taking this to the educational sphere. It means that parents do really well if with each one of their kids they're doing things for others.
Yep.
On a very frequent basis. And schools have a duty to raise kids to look outwards and do stuff for other people.
Yeah.
So if we forget to teach kids why are we doing all this, why are we sitting in a room doing maths? We're sitting in a room doing maths to prepare our talent so that we can serve.
Yes.
We're not doing it so that we can get a high ATAR and then get a good wage with a good job.
Yep.
Those things are ancillary because we will only be fulfilled in serving people.
Well, we're getting that. It's interesting coming at university level now. We're seeing it manifest a lot more that the ATAR is obsessive in the high school system, and then they get to university and they find out it actually has almost no bearing in how well they do in university, because the we'll talk some other time about the connection between HSC and university, or the non-connection. But then when they get there, there's still the obsession with, and they all constantly ask us in philosophy and theology, what job is at the end of this? And parents actually put a huge amount of pressure on young kids who want to think and they want to explore, like, oh, but what job do you have? And I have to confess, as a parent, I've had the same kind of angst as my two of my children now have had started arts degrees.
They'll be set for life.
Well, this is it. I wish I had have done arts rather than engineering as my first sort of attempt. I didn't finish engineering, but I did okay in it. But I wish I'd done arts because that was the period of my life when I most wanted to think and explore and test the boundaries and go, who am I? And what does me look like in this world? Instead of sort of rigidly going towards a particular function in society.
So I was showing, I'm with university students now in Melbourne, and I was showing them the Kurosawa movie Ran the other day, which is the Japanese version of King Lear in a sense, right?
Oh, right.
And the message, blood. The message is the message.
Japanese,
yes, but it's marvelous, right?
And swords.
What's the message? The message is self-knowledge. The message is that we've really got to seek the truth, and we've got to seek the truth about ourselves.
Yep.
And then we can't treat other people well unless we're immersed in the truth, you know?
So would you say, summing up this episode, that success in education is when we have participated in helping someone to become a great person in terms of character?
Yes. And I think then we would need to clarify what we mean by character.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm talking about virtue, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
habits of goodness.
Habits of goodness, particularly habits of empowering us to love, to give of ourselves to others, the gift of self.
Yeah. I can't remember if I've told this story on the podcast before, and I'm going to try and tell it without choking up, but I knew my son actually might turn out okay when he was 12 years old, and I was his cricket coach, and I'm a stickler for rules in cricket, and so I absolutely insisted on all the forms of cricket. I love the whole sort of regal majesty of it. Except when a young fellow who had been introduced to our cricket team for 1 week, I think, or just introduced because his father had died and he was looking for male input, and we put him into the team, he went out to bat and he got bowled first ball. And I thought, oh no. And my son, who was captain of the team, ran out on the field. And I immediately went, no, you're not allowed on the field. And I was yelling at him, breaking the rules. He went out to the other kid, put his arm around him and walked him off the field. And I thought, that's a man.
Yeah, very nice.
And it was when he disobeyed me. I'm not encouraging disobedience, but he went against what I had told him to do because he knew something was more important. And he made that judgment on his own. And it was correct. It was a good judgment. It was a judgment of the heart. So, yeah, I felt that that was the moment. I thought, oh, this might actually work out.
Very nice.
We watched To Kill a Mockingbird, that old movie, the Gregory Peck movie, with the kids a couple of weekends ago. We've established family movie night on the weekends, which is great. We sit down with a big bowl of popcorn and watch some classic. It was Ben-Hur a little while ago as well. And it really struck me with the son, Jem, that there are a couple of moments where the father says, I want you to do this. And Jem says, no, I'm not doing that. And and you can see the father's like, oh gosh, how am I going to, you know, deal with this situation? And toward the end of the movie, he turns to his son and the son says, Dad, can I come with you? And Gregory Peck, Atticus, says, no, son, I don't want you to come. And he just says, Dad, I'm coming with you. And he turns and looks him in the eye and says, all right, son. And he comes with him. And it's this sort of really, you know, here he is making his own decision. He sees that actually I do need the support that I didn't really think that I did need from a 12-year-old boy, and off we go together. It was quite one of the, yeah, it just reminded me of what you're talking about there, Peter.
Yeah. Well, it's probably time to wrap it up. Education is personal. We might need to change the title of this podcast.
Can I give you one story?
Go ahead.
One story to finish. How can schools work with parents in really vital moments?
Okay.
So this is a true story. Very early in the days of Redfield, we got a phone call from a local shopkeeper to say that, oh, we've got one of your students here. He's been shoplifting. So we said, okay, leave it with us. It wasn't your son. So the next morning, the boy comes in and we say, listen, Mum and Dad have to know about this. You need to go and talk to them. And he goes white.
Mm-hmm.
And then we rang his dad and didn't tell him what the problem was, but we knew his dad was fairly feisty. And we said, listen, your son has something big to tell you today, but hear him out.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, the father rang us to say, thank you. My son grew 6 inches last night and we've had the best conversation we've ever had. And I thought, that's a win. That's fantastic. He took him back and to the shop and everything.
Yeah.
But when that boy left school 8 years later, I asked his class, I want each of you guys to write down what's your best memory of your school years. And he wrote about that conversation with his dad. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the more we can reinforce the work of parents, the more impact we're going to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Hmm. And our job becomes more difficult because we're supposed to treat them as adults who aren't necessarily
shoplifters.
Gosh, I hope not at that point. But we're sort of, we have to treat them as adults who we know have these family contexts, but actually we can't bring the parents in. Yeah. So it's not
it's
as
time
though
for them to be grown-ups.
We can't actually have, legally, we can't have those conversations with the parents.
Even when the parents try to get involved, we actually can't talk to them about it because it's legally, they're adults now and they run their own show. I've got a tear in my eye after that story, Andy.
Me too.
It's time for 1 Minute Wonder. I mean, if we couldn't get any better. So this is the time of the show where we talk about something we've seen or heard or experienced this week that made us stop and wonder, something that made us smile or appreciate life a little more. Renee.
So last night I went home and I said, oh gosh, 1 Minute Wonder. What's been wonderful this week? I can't think of anything. And my husband said, no, that poem you came up with the other day. And it's true. Whenever I get stressed out, poetry starts going through my head. And we were talking about the Beatitudes and I thought of this poem by Richard Wilbur that I had learned when I was in uni. And it's really about the Beatitudes. So it's called Two Voices in a Meadow. And the first part is about a milkweed and the next part is about a stone. And the milkweed reminded me of Blessed are the meek, for they shall possess the earth.
Lovely. Andy.
Okay, we can't do the difference between boys and girls here.
You got to put me on the spot with that one, Andy.
Talk about sport. You'll be right.
I was with some friends in Wagga and Dad brings out from the garage a cheap Australian Geographic telescope.
Right.
And the night was super clear. The moon hadn't come up yet. And he said, we can see Jupiter. So we pointed it and we got the moons of Jupiter.
Oh.
Right.
Which was
amazing.
If
That's
you've never fantastic. Seen them, they're beautiful, right? Yeah. But then he said, Saturn's there. So then we got Saturn And for the second time in my life, I saw the rings of Saturn.
Oh, wow.
And
it's so majestic.
It's majestic,
isn't it?
But yeah. It's just such a moment, you know, where you realize this is such a special sort of privilege to be able to see something so far away, but so beautiful, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, Australian Geographic Telescopes, $100.
And you have to be out somewhere where you can see the night sky.
Because we've got a telescope and you're in Sydney, not so much. I did a bit of thinking about music. We've had a recent podcast on music and involvement. And then I got into some lyrics which were very different from the music I talked about in the podcast, and Leonard Cohen. And I've been looking at, in particular, one song, and one line in one of the songs was, "Where do all the highways go now that we are free?" And he's talking about that whole song is an amazing song, but he's not the artist I would have gravitated to. The style of his singing doesn't work. But when I read his lyrics, I think, man, I need to go back and listen to him. He's got really profound, searching lyrics. Yeah. So anyway, that's my One Minute Wonder for today. That's it for this week's podcast. If today's discussion got you thinking or arguing with your podcast device, let us know. You can subscribe to the podcast at thiscatholiclife.com.au. You can tell us what you liked, what you didn't like, what you'd like to discuss in future episodes by dropping us a line at info@thiscatholiclife.com.au, at our Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or Discord chats, and you can find the links to all of the things that we discussed in today's show in the show notes. Be sure to write us a review on iTunes. Remember, the more reviews we get, the more chance there are that other people will find us, and it helps us to be known to people who don't otherwise know us. Remember, this is a uniquely Australian Catholic podcast, so we think that's a good idea, an idea worth getting behind. Tell your friends. Before we go, it's time for some shout-outs. What have you got for us, Renee?
I didn't think of a shout-out. A shout-out to my husband.
There you go. That's a good one. We should do that a bit more often, perhaps.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
Andy?
Oh, poor beleaguered Melbourne, we're thinking of you.
My shout-out is to all sports supporters. We're in the season for things wrapping up for winter sports, and in the season for starting up for summer sports. So it's a good changeover period. It's a period of excitement. It's worth getting involved. There's something actually really good and wholesome about the striving and seeing all the people out there getting into one, you know, the changeover of sports. It's great fun. That's all for now. Thanks for listening to This Catholic Life.